Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Owning a home is a cornerstone of the American dream. It's seen as a sound financial investment and a way to build strong communities and good citizens. But is that really true? Brian McCabe explores that question in his new book, No Place Like Home, Wealth, Community, and the Politics of Homeownership. He's an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University, and he's with us now. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And take us back to this idea of homeownership and where it began in the United States. You start in 1931 with President Hoover.
That's right, Jeremy. So in 1931, President Hoover holds a conference on home building and home ownership in the United States. So, right, it's right around the time of the Great Depression. And there's an idea in the United States that if only we could get more people to buy homes and to want to own their own homes, then that would sort of help to lift the country out of the Depression, right? It would get a lot of people back to work in the building trades and in the construction trades at the time. So I think it's important to keep in mind at that point, right, the home ownership rate is about 45%, right? Nothing like what our home ownership rate is today.
Which is? And
almost 63, 64% today. Okay. So the story sort of starts 100 years ago, sort of thinking about why it was that home ownership became so important in the 1920s and the 1930s.
So in addition to trying to get more people to buy homes to rejuvenate the economy, there was another idea that this would keep people out of radical politics.
Yeah, that's right. And so some of what I dug up from the archive that's in the book is right, this story about how homeowners are better citizens. And so there's work about how home ownership would sort of stave off radical politics and these threats of Bolshevism in the 1920s and the 1930s, that homeowners made for better citizens and better community members. So there was something sort of very political about this idea of promoting home ownership at the time.
So we've got President Hoover's campaign to get more people to own homes in America. But then after World War II, the federal government really starts putting their money where their mouth is in terms of trying to get people to own their own homes.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that one of the things that sort of looking back becomes really interesting in the story is that today we're so used to this idea that the United States is the nation of homeowners, that sort of 63, 65% of us own our own homes, that kind of everybody aspires to ownership, that we forget that the United States wasn't always a nation of homeowners. And that's one of the things that I do in the book is I talk about various federal policies that really transition the country to being a nation of homeowners. So it's the National Housing Act of 1934, and that's where we kind of lay the groundwork for Fannie Mae, for a secondary mortgage market, for mortgage insurance. These are things that lower the cost of homeownership, making it easy for people to buy kind of over the 20th century. And then in the aftermath of the Second World War, right, a period of widespread suburbanization, and the GI Bill offers low-interest loans for lots of returning veterans to come and to buy homes in these suburban communities. So the argument in the chapter is that it wasn't that we were naturally a nation of homeowners, even though people do aspire to own their own homes, but actually a lot of this is built on federal policies, government policies that encourage people to own their own homes, to make home buying cheaper, to take the risk off of banks and put it onto the federal government when people buy their homes.
And largely, you write, it is based on this idea that by owning homes, we become better citizens. We're more involved in our communities. And this is the interesting thing about what you have said in this book is that you find that's not really true.
Yeah, that's right. I want to wrestle with an idea that on one hand, we do tend to think of homeowners as better citizens. And even today, if you look at the rhetoric that's used by Secretary Castro, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, President Clinton, President Obama, President Bush, right, it is that homeowners are better citizens. They're more engaged in their communities. And so I want to wrestle with that idea alongside this idea of building wealth and ask about how the importance of building wealth through homeownership changes the way that people become involved in their communities. And to really challenge this idea of whether homeowners, when they become involved in their neighborhoods, actually are acting in ways that are civic, that are necessarily good for communities.
So do property owners become more civically engaged and more active in their communities?
Yeah, well, they do, but in limited ways. And so I use some data that's from the Kennedy School at Harvard University about the ways that people build social capital and become involved in their neighborhoods. And what I show is that homeowners are involved in some kinds of activities. So if you look at voting in local elections, attending town meetings to discuss politics, working collectively to solve neighborhood problems, right? Those kinds of things you do actually see homeowners participating at higher rates. But if you look at another set of indicators that are measures of social capital, things that might be less instrumental, so volunteering in your neighborhood, socializing with your neighbors, joining things like school groups or religious groups, right? The kinds of things that we think build social capital in neighborhoods, that's actually not tied to homeownership. And so homeowners are becoming involved in their communities, but only in very limited ways, right? And what I argue in the book is that those ways are very much tied to property values, right? Those are things voting in elections, attending town meetings, talking about politics.
They just want to keep their home values up is what you're saying.
That's right. They're engaging in ways that can keep their home values up.
Is there anything wrong with that, though? I mean, if they're trying to keep their home values up and the side effect of that is that their community stays nicer than it otherwise would, doesn't it accomplish the same goal?
I don't necessarily think of it as there's something wrong with that. I think that one of the things that homeowners often do is that they work to keep particular kinds of people or particular kinds of land uses out of their neighborhood. So, for example, in the book, I use a couple examples of a suburban community in the Midwest, very wealthy community where they were going to build some, you know, sort of affordable housing.
Winnetka, Illinois, you're talking about right outside of Chicago.
That's right. And I think, you know, Winnetka is a town like many, many other ones. And, you know, and homeowners in many ways didn't want that housing because they were concerned about property values, right? And so you get communities, I think, that are often more exclusive, more segregated because homeowners don't want particular kinds of land uses in their neighborhoods because they're concerned about property values being driven down.
You call that the politics of exclusion.
That's right, the politics of exclusion. And thinking about the idea that civic engagement isn't necessarily always good, right? It's not always in the interest of larger communities or larger groups of people when homeowners are participating, right? Often they narrow the conversation, so conversations in community become just about what's going on with property values by pointing to themselves as taxpayers, even though, right, of course, renters are taxpayers as well. So I argue that there's sort of all these things that homeowners do when they engage in the politics of exclusion that may not be good for communities.
And speaking of the politics of exclusion, the whole system you point out of getting people into loans that they can afford and allowing them to go out and buy homes does favor white, more well-off people in this country in general.
Yeah, and that's one of the real challenges, I think, in thinking about homeownership more broadly, right, is that homeownership, we talk about this as this very inclusive institution, right, that everybody should have access to or should be able to buy a home if you just save enough. And yet, throughout our history, whites have had homeownership rates that are remarkably higher than African Americans today. It's 71 or 72% of whites own their homes compared to 41 or 42% of blacks. So there's this huge disparity. We saw during the housing crisis that even for black and white families that were at the same level of wealth, blacks were more likely to get a subprime loan. So there is this whole history of exclusion and a sort of racialized exclusion when we think about home ownership.
Actually, when the crisis was going on, the financial crisis in this country and the housing collapse, I went and did some reporting in and around Memphis, Tennessee, where they were suing the banks over what they called reverse redlining. Basically, the banks had gone in to the neighborhoods that were heavily African American and got those people into subprime loans in much bigger numbers than they did in the white areas of town.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of this, I think, comes back to this rhetoric of home ownership, right? One of the arguments is that, you know, it's one of the few things that Americans agree on today. Regardless of your politics, regardless of your race, almost everybody believes that owning a home is a good thing. And so that ideology of home ownership, I think, was very much used during the housing crisis to convince people to buy homes that may not have been ready for it, that may not have understood the terms of their loans, right? They were being sort of peddled a product that they weren't going to be able to afford. And people knew that, but this ideology of home ownership is so strong that people were eager to be in homes, even though they were homes that they weren't going to be able to afford.
So if people are listening to you and they're saying, he's right, you know, home ownership, this has gotten out of hand, we shouldn't have it. The first thing that you would point to is, well, let's get rid of the mortgage interest deduction, which is one of the most popular things in the tax code right now.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think that the mortgage interest deduction is one of the costliest tax expenditures in the tax code, right? It costs the federal government more than $100 billion every year.
This allows you to deduct the interest that you pay on your mortgage from your taxes up to a certain level.
Right. And so economists have made this argument before, and it's sort of very well known that the mortgage interest deduction is regressive. It favors wealthy households. You have to itemize your deductions to get it. And it's also deeply inefficient, right? People that are on the margins of home ownership, right, the mortgage interest deduction isn't enabling them to buy a home. What it's enabling is wealthy people to buy larger homes, right, to consume more housing. Even beyond those critiques, I argue that our interest in home ownership as a financial investment, right, is changing the way way we're engaging in our communities and making us more exclusive in our politics. And therefore, the mortgage interest deduction, by encouraging us to see our homes sort of exclusively as a financial investment, is contributing to that problem.
You have a better solution?
Get rid of the mortgage interest deduction. So we need to separate out that homeownership is doing two things, right? So one is we're building wealth through homeownership. But a lot of the claims about civic engagement and building community that are good, right, people volunteering and getting to know our neighbors, that actually comes from being in your community for a long period of time, living in one place, getting to know the people around you, getting to know the organizations that are there. And I think for a long time, homeownership and residential stability, right, being in your neighborhood for a long time, those were really deeply interconnected. And I think the housing crisis sort of split those apart a little bit. So if I were to offer sort of the alternative, it's that if we want to build better citizens, if we want people to engage in their neighborhoods, to meet their neighbors, to build community, we should be subsidizing stability, encouraging people to stay rather than subsidizing ownership.
That's Brian McCabe, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Georgetown University. And his book is called No Place Like Home, Wealth, Community, and the Politics of Homeownership. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you, Jeremy.